Hello, and welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers and the literary arts in Astoria and the Lower Columbia region. I'm your guest host, Asher Finch. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. We talk about what motivates writers to do the work they do and ask them what they've learned through their creative practice. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to see you, Asher.
Good to see you, too. I have with me here Marianne Monson, the founder of the Writers Guild, writer of poetry, fiction, nonfiction, women's history, historical fiction, children's books, a little bit of everything under the sun.
Little bit of everything.
What is your preferred genre to be writing in this phase of your life?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I love all the genres that you just mentioned. I guess I just really love words. Like, the genres have typically mattered less to me than the quality of the words themselves, you know? So I started off writing as a journalist, meaning someone who writes a journal. So I started keeping a journal even before I could write. I was dictating one to my dad. And I have my earliest journal, like, where I have this really scrawly, you know, handwriting, like I'm just barely learning to write. And I found some mud from a dried up riverbed and I taped it in with scotch tape and I wrote, "Mud from a dried up riverbed, very interesting." So from my very earliest ages, I recognized the power and beauty of words. I think I just fell in love with them. I was lucky enough to be read to a lot as a kid. So almost any genre, poetry, nonfiction, fiction. I think if you really made me choose one and say, like, you only get to write this for the rest of your life, it would probably be historical fiction novels.
Do you find that, I have this picture in my head of you with this little journal taping in the mud. Do you still find yourself collecting bits of your life in journals, in writing? Do you still have that daily reflection?
Not daily. I've never been like the kind of person who wanted to do anything every single day, you know?
Fascinating.
I really crave, it's like, I guess a lot of creative people do. I crave a lot of like newness and variety and just being able to go with whatever I'm feeling that day, you know? So I'm not like a methodical, but I'm very consistent with my writing, but I write in bursts. I think about it more like episodically. Like, today I'm going to craft this scene. Today I'm going to revise this scene. Today I'm just going to pour out words and see where they go.
Interesting.
Yeah, that sense of exploration is just really important to me in my life and in my work.
Because we were just talking before we got on air about this idea of like transformation and taking bits of your life and being able to flow with it. And I know you're somebody who travels a lot and you experience a lot of different areas of the world. Do you find that the way that your writing and those bursts happen and what they're about, do they change depending on where you're at, like physically?
Yes, I'm very sensitive to my natural, like to my surroundings, very sensitive. I'm not somebody who could be happy in like a really sterile suburban environment.
I don't think most creatives probably could be, and to those who can, all the more power to you.
Like, there's that beautiful Albert Camus line that says, like, within myself in the midst of a winter I found an invincible summer. I'm paraphrasing that a little bit badly, but that's such a beautiful idea, and I love that. And I think that I understand the truth of that, that like regardless of our external circumstances, there is an inward life and journey that we can protect and carve space for that can be divorced from the outside realities.
Absolutely.
But and I love and guess gravitate towards stories of people who've had to to do that in order to survive, especially mm-hmm. like in war zones, you know?
Because a lot of your writing has been about war history in some way or another.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Opera Sisters, I know, is your mm-hmm. historical fiction novel. Mm-hmm. And then you've done a lot of women's history centered around like the Civil War, I think is what Frontier Grit was?
That's actually Women of the Blue and Gray.
Okay.
But it's about the women of the Civil War.
Yeah.
And I am really fascinated by the way that the experience of war, which is, you know, I guess often conceptualized as a very male-centric activity, and historically is a very male-centric activity, but how it impacts women, you know, who are very often guardians of social culture and family and, you know, and they do engage with war too, and they're not always only limited to that, but they do have a different connection, obviously, than men do with family. But yeah, I'm very interested in the way that war impacts women.
Fascinating.
And the way that women engage with war and survive during times of war and are able to preserve things during times of war. That's really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I've always been really interested like with the concept of resilience in general, just like how people, humans, manage to survive during excruciatingly difficult circumstances.
Well, and I think right now the word resilience is coming up a lot in all mm-hmm. aspects of life. And mm-hmm. I can see like in the time I've known you, it's been a repeated feature in a lot of the work I've seen from you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking back to, I know you have a poem that I really admire of yours about Frida Kahlo.
Mm.
And that reminds me of this idea of that resilience and that strength and that power and the femininity.
Yeah. Frida's amazing example of that. You know, an incredibly sensitive, artistic, creative soul who dealt with excruciating pain on a lot of different levels, emotional pain as well as physical pain. Yeah. And then really used, she was able to transform that pain into her creative work.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm glad you liked that poem. That poem is called Stillicide. And it is it's on my Substack for anybody who wants to look. And it may still be up on the Hoffman Center. It won second place in the Neocon Mountain Poetry Pack Prize. So folks could find it there. It's Stillicide. Yeah.
Beautiful. To go back to writing a little bit.
Yes.
And back to your craft and the practice of that.
Mm-hmm.
You moved to Astoria in 2017.
That's right.
What brought you here?
You know, honestly, some really challenging personal and professional events brought me here. It was a really, really difficult time in my life. I'd lost my job and over a situation that was not my fault, but and everything kind of fell apart. Like mm-hmm. it got really hard. I was a single mom and we were in Portland. And at that time, like housing was just going crazy.
I think in Portland, crisis. It still is.
Yes.
I mean, everywhere. Yes. But
that was the beginning of it. Yeah. Like when you could really just see the housing prices and the rental prices going crazy. And, mm-hmm. and as like, so I was a single mom. I had writing as a source of income. And then I also was teaching mm-hmm. at the community college. But when I lost my income, I just recognized there was nothing I was going to be able to do
mm-hmm.
that was going to increase my salary at the same rate that rent prices were going up and housing prices were going up. So I had sold my townhouse there and we were renting. We moved in temporarily with friends and I just tried to figure out what on earth I was doing with the rest of my life. And was just looking on Zillow and I just like widened out the search zone because I'd just have been looking in Portland because my kids is father lived in Hillsborough, so I kind of needed to be somewhat close to him because
regional.
So we were sharing kids. Anyway, then this house in Astoria popped up for sale, and I just happened to have a friend staying with me who was really good with historic homes
mm-hmm.
From Savannah, Georgia, of all places. So, I mean, the whole thing, like looking back now, is just, it's so miraculous.
Yeah.
Like, and it is a story of resilience and of, you know, reinventing yourself and of starting over again and of going to a new place for new opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, it's kind of incredible when I look at it, like how that really was one of the darkest, most difficult times of my whole life. And yet, like, every like major blessing, beautiful thing that would come later really came out of that moment of turning, which I guess is how stories usually operate, right? So we came out here, we walked through that house, and he said, Marianne, you should buy this house. He's like, it needed some repairs. He's like, it needs 30 grand of repairs, and then you'll have a bunch more than that of equity. He's like, so you should buy it. He's like, if you don't buy it, then maybe I will. So I put an offer on that house that had been on the market for a year, which is crazy to think of now. Yeah, yeah. With like the Astoria market. But so I moved my kids out here. They were both in high school, and everybody thought I was a little crazy. I thought I was a little crazy. But this ended up being just the perfect community for me to land in at that particular time. Mm-hmm. In terms of that historic house that had been beaten up a lot, it had been used as a rental, and it just kind of been badly treated, even though it had beautiful old bones. And so I just started like tearing into that house. It was so therapeutic for me to go in and start like releasing the layers of pain that had happened to it. Mm-hmm. And I felt this like strong connection with the people, the Finnish immigrants who had built that house originally.
Yeah.
Like on like kind of a spiritual cosmic level, I felt like they were so happy that I was had landed in the house. And so it became very healing for me. And then this community just became incredible. Like it just was such a perfect landing place with so many other creatives that I really hadn't had access to in the suburbs of Portland, you know? And this community just like scooped me up and supported me, loved me, helped me heal, helped me figure out how to keep creating. And then that's exactly when Frontier Grit came out. Was
in that same...
Yeah, was all during all of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so then Frontier Grit is now coming out in a paperback for the first time.
Yeah, because it's coming up on... So the first book came out in 2016.
Okay.
And so that was right when I was going through all of that. And actually, the sales of the book helped me buy my house here in Astoria.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. And then we moved here in 2017. And so, yeah, so 2015, you know, like kind of coming up, well, it's 9 years.
Yeah, almost 10.
Yeah, exactly. 2025. So then the second edition is coming out and it's a paperback.
That's really exciting.
Yeah. And I've done some like updating and revision of it too.
So. And then it sounds like you have a sequel to it in the works.
Yes. So, yeah. So this book sold better than any of my other books so far. It was nominated for an award with the American Library Association. Librarians just loved this book. They just picked it up and loved it. And it's kind of amazing because it's a collection of like 12 stories of 12 different incredible women and their resilience as they, you know, navigated the frontier, the American frontier. Mm-hmm. But it's just, it's so fascinating that it like paralleled my own journey of
regrowth and transformation.
Yes. And survival at the same time. So
is there any particular chapter or woman in the book that is your favorite or that you're the most drawn to?
Oh gosh. I really love them all, and it just kind of depends on the day, you know, but a couple of the stories that I love the most. I mean, so the only Oregonian woman in here is Abigail Scott Dunaway. Do you know who she is?
No.
Okay. So that's a story that I think like every Oregonian should know, but especially like female Oregonians, because she fought for 40 years for us to have the right to vote in Oregon.
Wild.
Yeah. Okay. She like dedicated her life to that. And she toured with Susan B. Anthony giving a lecture tour around the Pacific Northwest. Okay. They had eggs thrown at them. They were like audacious enough to say that women should be able to vote and have a presence in the political arena. So yeah. So and she was a pioneer first. She walked across the trail when she was a teenager, and she kept a journal. She was an avid journal writer. And the Oregon Historical Society still has boxes and boxes and boxes of her correspondence and her journal writing because she was
phenomenal.
Yeah, she's super prolific.
Were you able to go through that while writing the book?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was. I love the Oregon Historical Society. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing like seeing, you know, Abigail Scott Duniway's actual journal pages. I mean, they've been digitized, but you can see her actual handwriting
and the scrawling and the emotion in it as you're writing, especially when it comes to like self-reflective and journaling work.
Yes, and you can see the like splotches where the rain came through the canvas tent and fell on her journal and spread the ink, you know? I just love that physicality of
it. There's something so much more powerful in that, I think, than typing on a screen all day.
Yes. Yeah. It's true. And that's why I still do mostly journal and poetry. I write at longhand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I prefer that. The feel of the paper and the pen just changes it.
It's more sacred, and I think it's almost like a ritual in some way.
Yeah.
Do you have any rituals in your writing where, I know you said you write sporadic in bursts when you're inspired by one thing or another.
Right.
But every time you sit down at the page, is there anything that you do as a ritual for that?
I think it's more that I like try to get myself into a very specific headspace. And I guess what I would say is ritual is like keeping that time sacred. So I will tell people like, hey, I'm not going to be available for a couple hours, you know, and I'll tell like my husband if he's in the same house, like, I will show up when I'm done, but like, don't come and get me first. You know? Like,
so almost putting yourself on do not disturb.
Yeah, absolutely. I put myself on do not disturb because otherwise it's just so easy to get distracted. But I do have a meditation practice too. And so I love trying to integrate that. Almost every morning I will have a cup of tea and I will read a poem. I've been reading Logan Garner's poetry collection lately, but I'll just work my way through different ones, a poem a day. And then I meditate for 10 minutes and then I write. So,
brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's Logan's new collection, The Sin of Feeding Wild Birds.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. You got it. Yeah.
Which you can listen to, I think it was last month's episode of River Writers.
It was.
To hear Marianne interview Logan about his work.
That's right. Yeah. We've got all sorts of wonderful poets here, so there's no shortage of material to read. No.
The Astoria writing community is so, it's thriving and it's beautiful, and it's hard not to see why everyone is so drawn to it because of how thriving and beautiful the area is in nature.
Yes.
I was sitting down at the pier earlier and watched like a couple bald eagles fly overhead, and it just reminded me why I'm so in love with this place.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, I feel like this place is kind of like a charging station for me. Like, when I haven't been here for a little while, I feel all antsy. Like, I just need to get home. And when I'm here, my body just relaxes. I sleep better, you know?
Yes.
And it's just, it's incredibly inspirational for me, I think, because like you said, there's so many people here doing so much incredible creative work, but it's also the landscape, you know, going back to what we were saying about suburbs and being able to and just the sensitivity to the natural world. But I know from scientists that there's something about the fresh water of the river meeting the ocean water and that creates that brackish in between, and that it supports some of the richest and most biodiverse ecosystems on the planet.
Yeah, I was going to say there's something so beautiful about being the ocean, the river, the mountains, the forest. It's all within an arm's reach here.
Yes, exactly.
And it's, I don't know, something that feels out of this world sometimes.
Yeah.
For folks just tuning in, you're listening to River Writers. I'm your co-host, Asher Finch, here with Marianne Monson from the Writers Guild. So off air a little bit, we were talking about your journey to an MFA, specifically like as an option that I have started to explore and wanting to know a little bit more about yours. Do you want to speak a little bit about either your journey to the MFA program or pathways that it's given you?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, I knew I always wanted to be a writer. So I majored in English and then you know, graduated and was like, okay, there's actually not any jobs for novelists. You know, like, I can't just go find that job description. So, you know, I didn't want to teach at that time. I really wanted to get into, you know, writing? Book publishing.
Yeah.
Yes, writing, ideally. But I thought a good way to do that would be to work around books, you know, mm-hmm. and publishing. So I got a job as an intern and then slowly worked my way up to managing editor of the children's division at Beyond Words Publishing.
And that's over in Portland, right?
It's in Portland, yep. And I was there for a number of years. And then I decided to become a mom. Mm-hmm. And so I got pregnant with my son. And so I quit my full-time job and started focusing on being a mother, which I really loved very much. But I think, like a lot of moms, I felt kind of a shifting sense of, you know, it was very mixed feelings. Like, I loved being home with my son. I mm-hmm. loved being his primary caregiver. But also, after a busy career and intense schooling, you know, I missed that sense of purpose.
Yeah.
So I did start writing pretty seriously then. And mm-hmm. my first book, Finding Fairies, which is a children's book, came out the year Nathan was born, in the year 2000. So that was exciting and mm-hmm. gratifying. But I think, like many writers, early writers, I struggled with consistency. I struggled with a lot of sense of anxiety.
Sure.
And trying to wonder if I was good enough. And so when he was around 1.5, I decided to go back for an MFA mm-hmm. in creative writing. And I chose Vermont College of Fine Arts because they had a low residency program.
So you could balance your life with your child at home and your program.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And so I did 1 year of the program and mm-hmm. then my daughter was born. So they allowed me to take a year off.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm. And then I went back when she was 1 mm-hmm. and I graduated when she was 2. So, yeah.
So this was almost 25 years ago.
Yes.
Before we had online classes the way we do today.
That's right.
What did a low residency program look like at that point in time?
Yeah. So I flew every 6 months at the beginning of each semester to mm-hmm. Vermont, to Montpelier, Vermont, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful, magical little state. I mean, yeah. I loved spending time there. It's not unlike Oregon.
There's often a comparison between like fall in Vermont versus here on the coast.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Well, I just think the two states in general, they have a lot of artists, mm-hmm. a lot of writers, a lot of book lovers, a lot of nature lovers, a lot of a lot of natural beauty. So it was a place that felt both familiar and different. And we would basically have these 10-day really intensive residencies where we were in lectures, discussions, and workshops from, you know, 8 in the morning until 8 at night, like 12-hour days, like really. So it's pretty intense with the cohort that you go through. And of course, since I split it up, I ended up with two cohorts of people that I worked closely with. But for me, I really credit, you know, I think the MFA can be not the right path for a lot of people for mm-hmm. lots of different reasons. If they don't necessarily want to teach, certainly you don't have to get an MFA to become a published writer.
Yeah.
But for me, it was so helpful to just form really good habits mm-hmm. of making my work a priority and carving out that space, that time to write, and also just having a front row seat for a lot of incredible authors whose work I admired, like Kathy Appelt and M.T. Anderson. I would say two who were particularly impactful that I feel so honored to have had the chance to work closely with mm-hmm. and to see how their writing process works.
Sure.
And it sort of demystified it, because with those kinds of successful writers, what you see is the end final product that they've put out into the world. And in an MFA program, often, and it was the case for me with those two writers, they were just incredibly generous mm-hmm. with their first early drafts, you know?
I love that. Getting to see that raw stage.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they would, you know, be just very transparent about their process.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really helpful for me to see, like, okay, their early drafts, they're better than mine, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not, like, magically, like, a bajillion times better.
Yeah. And it's not a polished product on the first try.
Yes. That was actually maybe one of the biggest takeaways I had from that front row seat.
Yeah.
Was just seeing the level of which those writers particularly were committed to revision.
Yes.
Like, to revising over and over and over again. Like, I remember Tobin, whose published name is M.T. Anderson. He wrote Feed and mm-hmm. he's won a bunch of... He's an amazing writer. But, you know, I remember he had written an entire draft of a novel. And then... And it was really good, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. from my perspective. And then he decided that it really just needed to be told from a different character's perspective.
Yeah.
So he, like, tossed the entire manuscript and wrote the entire thing over again. You know, like, that level of commitment to quality
yes.
was really amazing for me to be around. And just seeing, I mean, there's just, like, so many things. We had, like, a constant parade of editors and other incredible authors, you know, coming through. So we had the chance to learn from Kate DiCamillo. And
that's
just
phenomenal.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was just a magical time if you're a writer, you know, mm-hmm. to just have close access to people who are doing that caliber of work is just so inspiring. And it really just set me firmly on the trajectory of being a writer in a way that nothing else could. And, you know, after the MFA, I actually went through a period where I struggled to get anything published, you know,
yeah.
where I was sending things out and getting lots of rejection letters
mm-hmm.
Until finally, you know, a publishing house picked up my work and said yes. And I've really mostly published with them ever since. But anyway, the discipline that I gained and the inspiration and the kind of like the knowledge base mm-hmm. That I gained from the MFA program is what fueled me to push through those tough years of rejection. You know,
access and the obligation mm-hmm. and that structure is,
yeah.
I think, really important for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely was for me. I'm super grateful for it. And frankly, if MFA programs were free, I would do one every 5 years.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And what an incredible thing it would be to have such open access to programs like that.
Yeah.
Have
yeah.
a low barrier to it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and
sure.
I think that's an opportunity that the Writers Guild is able to somewhat help mm-hmm. like local folks experience is those workshops, that experience and hearing from these authors in a way that is slightly more accessible to us here on the coast.
Absolutely. And I think if a writer listening to us wants an MFA program and can't afford one or can't figure it doesn't work for their life for whatever reason, really all you have to do is read a whole bunch of books.
Yes.
Talk about them with other book lovers. What
yes.
makes them work? What makes them not work sometimes? You know, and then find a mentor or two or three who is a writer who is writing in the genre you want to write, who is ahead of you on that journey
mm-hmm.
and, you know, establish some sort
of peers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's really the MFA program experience in a nutshell is that mm-hmm. mentorship, the community of other writers.
Yeah.
And a lot of reading. And a lot of writing.
Yeah. So. But I think, I mean, time and time again, authors have said the number one way to know how to write is to read.
Yes.
And I think it all goes back to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. We're all readers first.
Yeah.
For sure.
The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more and become a member by visiting thewritersguild.org. Until next time, I'm Asher Finch for River Writers.